If you can't impact at least a million people, then you're not able to even start to put a dent in the problem. We'd sold out of toilet paper, so if we were just a toilet paper company, we shouldn't have been engaging in any marketing or advertising when we had no inventory to sell. But we said, we're in the business of delight, and in March 2020, it feels like the world needs a little bit of extra delight. No one has ever asked me that before. It is a very tough question to answer.
Welcome to episode 1 of season 3 of the Make It Happen show. I'm Tim Morris, the CEO at The Entourage, and what a fantastic guest to have on to kick us off. We're joined by Simon Griffiths from Who Gives a Crap. Let's get into it. Simon Griffiths, it is so good to have you on the show. How are you doing?
Really good. It's been a really intense 2 years now that I think about it. Really good. Yeah, feeling like we're in a great place. So excited for everything that's happening now.
Nice. Well, because you've had some crazy times over the last 2 years. We've all had crazy times the last 2 years. Some businesses were really challenged. Some businesses had amazing growth. And I think you guys are probably in that latter camp. But with growth comes also challenge. So how's it been?
We're in both camps, to be honest. Yeah. So I think everyone sort of instantly says, you know, running a toilet paper company in 2020 or through the pandemic, you must have had a bunch of amazing growth. And that's, I think that's part of the story. You know, after we sold out in early March, we turned on an email sign up and ended up with more than 500,000 people on our waiting list. So that was kind of a bit of a shock, 2 years ago now. That was a pretty huge business challenge for the team to, you know, everyone to get their head around how we tried to service that many people. And the team did an amazing job, and that ultimately resulted in this massive donation, because we give away half of our profits each year. Mm-hmm. So we ended up donating a bit over 5 million Australian dollars in the end of June 2020, which was just, you know, incredible. Off the back of that, global supply chains melted down. Mm-hmm. We're still kind of in the thick of that now. That's, I think, been something that no one could have predicted. It seems completely disconnected to the pandemic, but is intertwined in a really interesting way. And so it's also a very hard problem to solve quickly. You know, you can't just put more ships on the water and make more containers. Like, it's not that simple, and that stuff takes time as well. Being a company that moves a bulky, low value product around, we've been probably harder hit than a lot of people on the supply chain side. So yeah, super interesting to kind of navigate that off, what was already a challenging 2020, 2021 became challenging in a very different way.
Yeah, gotcha. Yeah, because you've got all this huge demand. That, how do you deal with that? And then, yeah, when you have the supply issue as well, it's like a compounding effect. How's your team gone through this whole process?
Really good. I think, you know, really the early on through the pandemic, I think our team realized that this was kind of the moment we've been training for. Like, this was, you know, the 6 years prior were basically about getting us ready to, you know, to give us our moment, and it was our time to shine. And so, March, April, May of the pandemic, the team really rolled up their sleeves and jumped in, kind of super excited to try and break the back of this very hard problem of how do you get product to the most people possible, and did a really awesome job on that. I think then through, you know, August, September, most of our Australian team are in Victoria. Got a lot of Americans and Filipinos in our business as well. So kind of rolling lockdowns all around the world, but especially the Victorian team, everyone had holidays planned through, you know, the winter period. And when it's winter in Victoria, you go somewhere warm. When we were stuck in this, you know, 5 kilometer radius thing, everyone was working from home, kids at home. I think that was really hard. We ended up giving everyone basically an extra week off. I think now this has become quite common. A lot of companies have done this, but when we did it, no one else we'd seen globally had done this yet. And we realized that the team needed a circuit breaker to kind of get them through to the traditional holiday period at the end of the year. That extra week off, was just amazing in terms of, you know, the level of recovery and therefore the uplift in productivity that came from that as well. Mm. And now, you know, everyone's done this. Spotify, yeah. You know, Nike. I've seen so many companies do this since, and it's just something that makes complete sense. And then 2021, I think, you know, everyone was hoping 2021 would be an amazing year. I remember a lot of Twitter talking about, you know, the American summer being the hot girl summer when everyone was kind of vaxxed and getting back into the swing of life. But the reality was that, yeah, the supply chain challenges just really started to get, you know, a little bit strange in Feb, March, and by the end of the calendar year were like just completely dire. And so that's been really, again, kind of a moment for our team to shine, but now really the supply chain team rather than the kind of marketing retention and, you know, some of our supply chain that we're working on breaking the back of the big problem in 2020. So 2021's been quite different, but I think we're in a really good place now, excited to come out the back of it. Just, you know, a lot stronger as a business than what we were when we went into all of those supply chain challenges roughly a year ago. Yeah.
A couple of interesting things in that. First of all, great to see Spotify and all the rest taking your lead. well done. And the other part there is that I think that's awesome that you're looking after your team members, because they're obviously really connected to the mission of the business. Like, you're doing good things, like you're really making an impact. But that can't always be enough. And so obviously you had a good finger on the pulse of how they were feeling. And do you think you acted quickly in that sense?
Yeah, so we're very much a culture first business. We believe that culture comes before everything else. If you get culture wrong, then your customer service is bad, your, you know, physical product's probably going to be bad. And so we keep a very close ear, eye, finger. I don't know what you put on culture, but we're always trying to sort of just make sure that we're not doing things that could be problematic in the long run and trying to get an early read on that. And that's definitely what we got in this instance. We could, you know, from the surveys that we were doing weekly with our staff, we realized that people's productivity was going down. And as an executive team, I think all of us knew that we weren't doing our best work as well. Mm. And so, you know, we realized we needed a circuit breaker to get us through to the end of the year. And our sort of people lead had the idea that we should perhaps give everyone a week off. And as soon as she said it on the exec team call, everyone said, we've got to do it. Like, it just makes total sense. But coming back to purpose, I think the tricky thing about purpose is I actually think you're potentially at even greater risk of burnout than a company that doesn't rally around its purpose, because people are so invested in what you're trying to achieve. And everyone understands that it's bigger than the individual. And if something's bigger than the individual, then the individual can sometimes, you know, believe that they need to be sacrificed to the thing that's bigger than them. And that's not how we think about things, but you can end up in a situation where you feel like you can't let your team down or the company down, or that you just need to do this extra thing to enable us to unlock, you know, the next thing that we're trying to get to. And that can be a dangerous place. And so, I don't want to say with great power comes great responsibility, but there's probably a similar saying to that that applies in this situation.
A Spider-Man quote is always a good quote. So well done. But that's super interesting, actually, because I think we saw something similar with our team here at the Entourage as well. So particularly our coaches that work with the business owners, who are so invested in the members, like they are so invested in helping these business owners grow, that when the business owners are going through a very challenging time, as a bunch of them did in COVID, then the coaches took on tons of that emotional strain. It really took a toll on them for a little while. Now that we're on the other side, things are getting a lot better. But I think it's because, as you say, they're so invested in the purpose of the business, so invested in the outcomes, that they just take on way more than they probably should, and certainly more than someone in a corporate environment that doesn't really care about the product or the customer or whatever. So that's super interesting. And in hindsight, we should have been more attuned to that even here. I want to take a step back, though. Let's go way before COVID, right? It's amazing that you guys did have solid growth. You managed to donate more, totally get the supply chain challenges as well. But it certainly wasn't overnight success. Like, you've had 10 years before that of making toilet paper sexy. What have been some of the kind of building blocks to that? Like, how have you actually even gotten into the market, started making an impact and be in a position where you can really ride the wave up?
Yeah, I think you know, we'll talk about this, but before jumping into it, I think a lot of what I will say will feel a little bit almost like table stakes in running a business today. But what's interesting is that these were things that we were doing 10 years ago. And so, you know, it took maybe 6 or 7 years before they started to become on the radar of other people. And then the last few years have become, you know, a really kind of more of a playbook way of thinking about things. But they're the foundations that we built our business on and were very counterintuitive when we first started. And so I think the biggest things that we did were really early on, we thought about how to innovate in the customer experience rather than the physical product. And so when you think about toilet paper, you don't need 5, 8, 10 plies. Like, the actual innovation in the physical product isn't really all that necessary, but the room for innovation is everything that comes around the physical product. So for us, that means, you know, the impact, whether that's social or environmental with the donations, or, you know, how we think about how we make and transport our product, customer service when something goes wrong, like, how do we really innovate in that area to deliver a customer experience that's much better than what you can get elsewhere? Beautifully designed packaging, free fast home delivery, limited editions that we now do, you know, 2 or 3 times a year, where we change up the wrappers and create a bit of a different experience. We've got one live at the moment called Where's the Loo, which is like a Where's Wally with 12 different worlds, but you have to find the toilet, because, you know, finding a toilet is actually the reality for 2 billion people who don't have access to toilets today. And so we do all of these things that exist around the product, and that's what creates this, you know, ultimate experience that is much, much better than when you go and buy plastic wrap toilet paper on the shelf in a supermarket.
That really gels with our view of product. So we always say product is about, first of all, delivery on your promise. You know, deliver the product or the service, whatever you've promised to the customer, and that's more the mechanics of it. But then you level it up through delighting the customer. We always say that's the dynamics, like, how do you add an emotional connection on top, you know, a real resonance there? And then how do you amplify that, or get your customer to amplify it for you, so it kind of repeats the cycle? And I mean, I know you guys definitely do the delight thing really well, and I've heard you talk about delight a little bit. Do you want to dig into that?
Yeah, so we sort of, you know, the first two parts of what you talked about there, we talk about as deliver then delight. So the delight doesn't matter unless you can deliver. Yeah. And so in our instance, you want to think about how to make the customer experience, the need, you know, I need to buy the product. You want to make that part of the customer experience entirely frictionless. So it's ideally the fewest number of clicks from landing on your website to checking out and, you know, something showing up at your house really, really fast. And that should be super frictionless. And then the delight, we talk about being in the business of delight. So we sell toilet paper, but we're in the business of delight. And when you're in the business of delight, you can think about all of the things that you put around the business, around that frictionless experience, so that if customers want to dig deeper, they can and find something that's, you know, different to what they'd get somewhere else. So they're kind of the two big parts of that. And then the third part is, you said, you know, amplifying and getting other people to find out about what you're doing. For us, you know, word of mouth has always been our number one driver of new customers, and it still is today. And really the way that we do that is by creating moments that are very easy for someone to go and tell someone else about your product. So, you know, when someone's opening our boxes for the first time, we're saying, how do we make that so fun, so joyous that someone wants to take a photo of that moment and share it with one of their friends? You know, our email receipts were saying, how do we make them so unexpectedly funny or clever that someone would want to forward that email receipt to one of their friends? And we think through all of the different parts of our customer experience in that way by, you know, literally breaking every single part down into a stage from I'm thinking about buying toilet paper to I'm going to the shops or a website, thinking through every single part of those stages and then saying, how do we make that part of the stage frictionless? And then what's the delight that we can insert there, or where's the extra value we can deliver to the customer that they can't get somewhere else?
Yeah.
And when you layer all of those things on top of each other, then you create a product that's highly differentiated and hopefully has a lot of emotional attachment to it.
Yeah.
And We're rambling a little bit, but just bear with me on this one. You've just had me think about something else. But I think when you know, we try to make people fall in love with products. And when you fall in love with someone, there's part rational, which is about, does this person show up at the time that they say they will? Do they lie to me? Are they truthful? And then there's part emotional, which is, do they look great? Do they make me feel great about myself? And so, the rational benefits of our product is that frictionless customer experience. And then the emotional benefits are all of the other stuff that we can layer on there. Does this person give back? Do they have the same set of ethics and values that I do? And if we can get that right, that's how you start to make people fall in love with things, whether it's people or products.
Yeah, awesome. Yeah, I love that. That's exactly how we think about it as well. I've got a little story for you that I think might showcase how I think you're nailing a couple of those things. Now, obviously, I haven't told you this yet, but I was around at a friend's place not long ago, maybe only a couple of weeks. Actually, it's funny that you mentioned 6-ply, 7-ply. My friend could definitely, like, if they wanted to, they could have like silk finished toilet paper. But no, I walk into their bathroom and there's Who Gives a Crap right there. And I look at it and I at home have my favorite little saying on one of the rolls as a customer. I love the one that says, please do more ones and twos. And I look down at that, it wasn't that one. And I'm like, I wonder if it's around here somewhere. I turn around and I open this huge set of cupboards in their spare bathroom and it is full of Who Gives a Crap. I don't know how many rolls are there. There must have been a couple of hundred. And so I search through it and I find the one that says, please do more ones and twos. And I run downstairs, River, and I go, this is my favorite roll. I think it's so funny. Look, everyone wasn't quite as amused as I was in that moment, but I think I'd gone through that whole cycle of they've obviously got the product seamless delivery. It's definitely delighting me and I'm trying to amplify it to everyone else, but out of context was a little strange.
Yeah, that's awesome. And to, the point is that if you can do that with toilet paper, you can do that with anything,
yeah.
Right? Like that's kind of what's so interesting about our product in particular.
And do you think it's actually been a benefit to you that it is in one regard, toilet paper is toilet paper, right? The product side of it, the actual physical product, the innovation isn't super hard. And has that allowed you then to say, right, we've got that sorted, let's innovate in terms of the emotional experience? Has that been a benefit for you?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, it's also, toilet paper is an interesting product because it's also a product that a lot of people don't think about, but they have very high brand loyalty because they say, I don't care what I get as long as it's that brand because they know that, that's been a reliable choice for them in the past and they don't want to place any risk in this very kind of personal moment in the bathroom or be embarrassed if they have friends that come around or something along those lines. And so I think there's two sides to it. One is that, that there hasn't been a ton of innovation, particularly in marketing, which has been focused around puppies, pillows, feathers and bears globally. It's the same. And so what we did was create an opportunity to talk about what the product was actually used for by tying it back to the cause that we're, trying to solve. Mm-hmm. And that gave us not only differentiated marketing, but marketing that no one else could go after because their brands don't allow them, their brand guidelines won't let them talk about what the product's actually used for. I think it's also a challenging one because there is a lot of brand loyalty there. And so you have to figure out how to switch someone up from what they're using. And that's not about just trial. It's also about repeat purchase and coming back.
What's been the best campaign or thing that you've done? I mean, I love that Where's the Loo. That sounds awesome. But what's been your favorite thing that you've ever done?
No one has ever asked me that before. It is a very tough question to answer. I think, we do a lot of amazing limited editions that are super fun. We won some pretty big awards a couple of years ago for one that was kind of like an exquisite corpse where you had different heads, bodies and legs on rolls and you could turn them around to create different creatures. And so I'm not a designer, but all of our designers were like gushing because we won the Golden Pencil or something, like a huge global award for this edition that we did, which was pretty amazing to kind of, see toilet paper being recognized as like a designed product that, delivers that bit of delight to people. Yeah. One of my favorite things that we did was during the first month of the pandemic, we talked about being in the business of delight. We'd sold out of toilet paper. So if we were just a toilet paper company, we shouldn't have been engaging in any marketing or advertising when we had no inventory to sell. But we said, we're in the business of delight. And in March 2020, it feels like the world needs a little bit of extra delight. And so we took out full page ads in The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald, advertising that we'd run out of toilet paper, but we thought that everyone else had too. And so we'd printed this ad for you to use in the case of an emergency. And we saw that being shared on social media just over and over again, you know, delivering that bit of delight in a moment where the world felt like it was falling to pieces.
Yeah, that's very clever. Awesome. We've talked about your team a little bit, but I'd love to really dig into how it's evolved just over the whole journey. So, you know, I imagine, you know, early days you would have been doing everything, right? You and your co-founders and the early people on the journey would have been absolutely doing everything. And then, so I'm interested to know, like, what are the big levelings up of the team? What's it like now as you guys go on your future growth plans? What do you need in place? I'd just love to hear that whole journey.
Yeah, sure. So we started, you know, as a bootstrap business. We were bootstrapped for the first 8 or 9 years. So, you know, I think I was working a 3-quarter week as the only kind of team member initially. And then I became the third employee to actually get paid because we couldn't afford to pay me. And so we had to bring on other people to, you know, help us get the things that we had to do done before I could actually draw a salary myself. So yeah, very much, you know, really did everything initially, and then over time have gone through that journey of chief doer to chief manager to, you know, chief leader or visionary or whatever you kind of want that third one to be. And that's been a pretty challenging journey because most of our team hadn't had that much experience working for other people before they worked for us. And so we didn't know what good management looked like. We didn't know, you know, what were the right things to say to people at the right moments to make them feel, you know, really valued even as employees. And so we had to learn all of that stuff as we went, which meant that we made a ton of mistakes along the way. But really kind of, you know, being conscious about putting people first through that whole journey meant that we wanted to hire a head of people much earlier than a normal business does. And, you know, she's now part of our executive team and does an amazing job kind of putting the rigor into all of the people processes in our business, which I think now is kind of one of our, you know, much stronger parts of our business overall, which is great.
What stage was that at? Like roughly how many people in the business when you brought a head of people in?
I think we were 17, but we were also fully remote at the time. Mm. So I think in a remote team, you feel the strain of growth faster on the people side of the business than you do in a team where you're all in the office together. Yep. Because, you know, the lack of water cooler conversations or overhearing what other parts of the business are working on, you have to design people, processes, and systems to enable those things to occur without letting it tear the company apart. If you end up with people who are too siloed or, you know, don't have the right management tools and processes in place. And so I think a lot of people do that, get a head of people around 50 people. But yeah, we chose to do it much, much, much earlier because we said, you know, basically the right person in this role will give us, you know, an extra 10 to 20% extra productivity out of the entire team. Like this role pays for itself on, you know, week one, basically. And so that was, yeah, a very conscious early decision that we made and something that's been very powerful for us ever since.
It's kind of, I was actually thinking the other day that businesses that do stay remote after the pandemic and say they have these savings from their office spaces, I think the first thing they're going to have to invest in is teams or people to keep everyone together, aligned, motivated. Because you're right, it is, you know, people come into in a growth business, when people are together, they kind of share the journey a little bit more. And we certainly saw it when you're fragmented, it's just tougher on everyone individually. So those that stay remote, probably going to have to follow your footsteps here as well.
Yeah. And now, you know, we moved to a hybrid structure before the pandemic about 2 years prior, where we said, instead of hiring anyone anywhere, we're going to hire in our core city hubs, so Melbourne, Los Angeles, Manila. And then we have a remote team in China and now in Europe as well. And the idea was that by hiring in those cities, we could bring people together on whatever frequency they chose as a city hub to come together. So in Melbourne, everyone said, I actually prefer working with my headphones on at home. So I'll come into the office, you know, one day a week at least, and I'll choose the day. Whereas in LA, they said, we're more collaborative in terms of, you know, our functional responsibilities with marketing, creative, digital product. So we want to be in the office 3 days a week, and it's going to be Monday, Wednesday, Thursday. And so, you know, by taking that approach, we got the benefits of FaceTime with also the benefits of a more flexible working environment. And we say there's a ton of benefits from having that remote setup. You can prioritize life over work a lot of the time. For me, for example, I prefer to be in nature, so I can live outside of a city and commute into the city on a less regular basis when I need to for meetings. But it does come with some, you know, there's some tension there. There's some challenges as well. And so you have to build the right systems around those challenges to try and overcome them. You know, for me personally, I'd split time between Australia and Los Angeles. I'll do that again this year for the first time. So really start to, you know, truly understand what it's like working out of that hub on the other side of COVID now.
Yeah, yeah. We've got a team in Manila as well. Had that team there for about 4 years now. And I used to get over there heaps to work with that team. And then obviously haven't been for 2 years. And you're right, they're at different stages. They're still all remote, whereas our team here in Sydney is back in the office a couple of days a week and working from home a couple of days a week, but the Manila team is still all remote. But we're starting to think, okay, how and how frequently do we bring them back together? When can we get back over there? Yeah, yeah. But you're right, there's still a couple of things to change.
One of the biggest moments of the year for us has always been bringing the whole team together.
Oh, yeah.
And so we do that in a different city every year. So the first year was in Melbourne and we brought our Filipino and US teams over to, you know, in a lot of cases, like meet customers for the first time, see product out in the wild for the first time.
Try good coffee for the first time.
Yeah. And then, you know, the next year was in Cambodia where we went to see WaterAid's work firsthand. The year after in Manila, trying to build empathy for what it's like to work in the Filipino hub. Yeah, right now we're missing a lot of the core stuff that we do to bring the team together and rally around a shared set of goals once a year.
Yeah. And so what are you doing sort of in the meantime to preserve or even amplify the culture and the connection with the vision of the business? Are there a couple of new things you've added in?
Yeah, so I sort of hinted at this, but we used to take the team into the field every second year to visit the work of our partners firsthand. And that was an amazing moment to kind of connect into the purpose of the business. This year, we've got a team heading into the field, just a very small team heading into the field to start kind of thinking about how we do this without having the entire company there for those experiences. And it's twofold. One is that, you know, there's an equity issue around some people not being able to travel because of, you know, what's going on in their country. And the other is that now we're a team of 165 people. You can't take 165 people into a small village and say, hey, you know, like, let's talk about your toilets. Like, it's not an experience that makes any sense for, you know, the people on the other side of that equation. Yeah. And so we have to change up how we connect people into the purpose, given that, you know, the last time we were able to do it, we were a team of 34 people and it was a bit different.
Yeah, yeah. I can see the poor village just wanting the 165 to leave. I just want to go to the toilet in peace. Get out of here.
Yeah, for real.
But I think everyone's journey for the last 2 years, there has been silver linings in all of the different challenges that we've had to navigate. Like, I think if you can, for a lot of people, you've been able to figure out new ways of working that once, well, if everything's ever back to normal, who knows, but, you know, back to the new normal, we figure out new ways of working that actually in the future will be better. So for you cracking that nut of how do we immerse ourselves, but we can't take everyone, but we want everyone to have the experience, like, you'll figure that out and it'll be a smarter way for your next stage of growth. We've done similar stuff with how we deliver our product and also how you hire and lead team members. And so it's about, I'm a big advocate of, like, yes, there's been a lot of change. Yes, we've had to change how we operate our businesses, but there should in each of those changes be a good silver lining that you can carry forward with.
Yeah, I think that's 100% correct. And a good example of that is that week where we brought everyone together globally. We used to use that to launch our annual strategy, and that made it very hard to coordinate because you had to do that on a, you know, a very specific time of the year to get ready for the next year. And so now that we've figured out how to do that, you know, virtually with kind of this virtual week that we run, it gives us a lot more flexibility on how we think about, you know, bringing the team together, connecting to strategy and how that can be different to connecting to impact, which, you know, is now something that can be done by itself.
I won't sidetrack us with this, but I did a board meeting in the metaverse the other day in VR, and oh my God, it was amazing. This is how we'll be able to do some of this stuff in the future. But anyway, let's not go down there because I've got a couple of questions that I want to get through. We call it Make It Happen in a Minute. Five questions developed by Anna that we move through in reasonably rapid fashion. You ready to get into it?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. number one, what's your favorite toilet-related joke or fact that most people wouldn't have heard of?
I tell this joke all the time, and I'm still surprised by how many people don't know the punchline. And it's my five-year-old's favorite joke. So why did the toilet paper roll down the hill?
I don't know why. No.
To get to the bottom.
Hey, my five-year-old is going to love that when I tell him tonight. That's good.
The other stat there that's interesting is there's more mobile phones in the world than toilets, which or more people have a mobile phone than a toilet, which is kind of crazy that, you know, like when you think about the hierarchy of needs, that's the way that the world's going. Yeah.
I was going to try and say, like, is it easier to share a toilet or a mobile phone? I don't know. It still means everyone should have access. Question number two, what's one way... this is cool. It's riffing on something we've talked about, but it's a new version of it. What's one way business owners can bring more delight into their day-to-day activities?
Into their day-to-day activities. I really come back to this belief, this philosophy of being in the business of delight. Mm. So forget what you sell and think about how you can deliver delight, whether that's to your employees or to your customers, and changing up your mindset around how you think about that, I think creates a lot of opportunities to do things differently. We put lots of jokes through our communications. We think about our customer service as being first frictionless and then second having an element of delight. And we put budgets behind that so that our customer service, our customer happiness team can go and delight customers with a budget when they, you know, think that they can go above and beyond. That doesn't make sense if you're trying to sell someone toilet paper to like spend money on delighting someone, but it, you know, like be in the business of delight and you start to see amazing things happen.
But it does make sense because that's how you differentiate and that's how you build relationship and that's how you have loyal customers. So most people don't think of it, but it's how you get it done. Question number three, if you were just starting Who Gives a Crap today, would you sit on a toilet for 50 hours again, your crowdfunding campaign, or would you try something different?
I think the initial crowdfunding campaign was such an amazing way to get started. You know, the virality that came from pledging to sit on a toilet on a live feed until we hit our pre-sales target was awesome. I would fall apart. I'm 12 years older or whatever, 10 years older than what I was when I did that. There is no way my body would let me do that today. So if I could wind back time, would I do it again? For sure. Would I do it again today? Like, I don't think it would be possible.
Good answer. Yeah. Would the 12-year younger you do it? Yes. Question number four. What's your number one indicator of future success in a potential employee?
I mean, I think like really this comes back to like the hunger to learn, you know, the passion for learning and being intrigued. Learning, I think, has two elements to it. One is where you have directed learning, where someone's training you how to do something. And the other is being inquisitive. I call it turning over the rocks to see what's under them. So, I love that idea of people getting given something and then wanting to like turn over the rocks to see if there's something under there, then turn over the next one until they find a bug and say, well, what is that? You know, what is that interesting insect that's under this rock, and keeping on going. And so I think about those two elements of learning, and when you get them combined in an individual, it's incredibly powerful because they can learn things very quickly in a direct environment, but also help you to find things that you might not have seen yourself by being intrigued and inquisitive.
An idea for a new interview technique here. You could make basically your own version of an escape room for the interview, and they have some instructions but also some clues around the place, and if they follow the instructions and find all the clues, great employee. If they want to still work for you.
Yeah, I mean, we did an escape room as a company a few years back, and I found myself standing in the room directing people to do things, which was a really strange experience when I was always the person that would go and try and solve the problem. So it might be a challenging interview environment depending on what role you're hiring for, I think. But yeah.
All right, final question. Then we'll wrap up with some final comments. If someone wants to stand out to make an impact on the world at scale, what's the one thing they need to do to make it happen?
So this is a really interesting question because you're saying at scale. And when you think about, you know, the problem we're trying to solve, there's 2 billion people globally without access to adequate sanitation today. And so the at scale part of this basically means that if you can't impact at least 1 million people, then you're not able to even start to put a dent in the problem, and you probably need to find a different solution to go after it. And so always asking yourselves, you know, is this the idea that can help us impact, you know, at least 1 million people, hopefully many, many more than that, but at least 1 million people, I think, is the kind of baseline that you have to set before you go after ideas that can operate at massive scale.
And I mean, follow on question for me, how does that work with the kind of idea of just like testing something, getting your idea up, seeing if there's a bit of traction? Do you have to evolve the idea as you go along so it can scale to 1 million people, or is it like trial it out, and if that hasn't got the scalable potential, just try and like pivot slightly or move to a parallel idea that can scale? You got some thoughts around that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, the first time you test something, you're just trying to understand whether someone will buy this product and, you know, want to buy it again. You're not trying to test out whether this idea can be the thing that, you know, gets you to the impacting 1 million people's lives. And so for me, that's a test that comes later on, or it's the overall objective that, you know, you've got, but the objective of this first test will be quite different to that. And so you sort of have to build up to that objective over time, or have a hypothesis that, you know, after you've done many iterations, you'll start to understand the virality of what you're doing and therefore how many people it can reach. And that can be, you know, the starting point of understanding whether you can reach that scale over time.
Yeah, awesome. Simon Griffith, it's been a really great conversation. There's so much we haven't even touched on. I mean, I know you guys are turbocharging your growth. You're also making a lot of impact. You've got brilliant stories as well. So for anyone listening that isn't already a Who Gives a Crap customer, go and check them out, because I think it's really, really inspiring. So well done on 12 years of, you know, hard graft, making an impact. It's so good to see just how much more impact you've been able to make over the last couple of years. Obviously not without its challenges. Thanks for coming and sharing your story.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to the Make It Happen show, brought to you by our team at The Entourage, Australia's leading business coaching and training provider. We're on a mission to empower entrepreneurs by giving them everything they need to build great businesses and live meaningful lives. If you got something out of this episode, picked up a great takeaway, or just want to say hi, don't forget to leave us a review on iTunes or let us know at The Entourage Official on all social platforms. We'd love to hear from you. Catch you in the next episode with our next guest right here. Bye for now.